enter the far middle at your own peril and listen to the next 30 minutes or so of what is shaking in the region and in the nation and the world these days. Well, these days are the dog days of summer. Here we are in early August, and I noticed driving around Western Pennsylvania, a lot of high school and college football camps in full swing. I see those players out there in the heat, just sort of dying and sweating as they're going through the practices and the drills. And before we know it, college is going to kick off, and then comes the NFL in about a month, so time's flying. Now, watching all those practices out there across all those football fields in Western Pennsylvania got me thinking about episode 63's dedication. And two players came to mind when I thought the number 63. Both of them are football Hall of Fame greats. And they're Willie Lanier of the Chiefs and Gene Upshaw from the Raiders. One, of course, was a great linebacker. That was Willie Lanier. His nickname was Contact because of the way he tackled. And the other was a great offensive lineman, of course, with Upshaw. So who do I pick? You know, which one of these two greats? And they both played in sort of the late 60s and through the 70s. Which 63 of these two? So when I'm trying to figure out which one to pick for the dedication, I came across something that gave me an out from having to select between Upshaw and Lanier and the dilemma that came with it. And I can share it with you on the far middle. Back in 1968, the Chiefs and the Raiders, two hated rivals, of course, they were squaring off in a playoff game in Oakland at the old Coliseum. And the two captains headed out to midfield for the coin flip at the start of the game. So who were the captains of each team? Gene Upshaw, 63 for the Raiders. Willie Lanier, 63 for the Chiefs. So Willie Lanier, he wins the coin toss. And Willie Lanier said the Chiefs would defend the south goal line, which meant the Raiders were going to receive the kickoff at the start of both halves. So Kansas City obviously believed its powerful defense was going to be able to stymie and shut down the Raiders' offense. They didn't seem to be that worried about the Raiders' offense to the point where they'd cede the ball to them at the start of both halves. So you what? Upshaw asked incredulously when Lanier repeated it, that he was going to defer and let the Raiders take the opening kickoff if he could defend the south side of the stadium. Upshaw responded with, "You'll regret this." And he yelled the same thing to the Chiefs coach, which of course at the time was the Hall of Famer Hank Stram, and over to the Kansas City sideline as well. Again, these were two big rivals, these teams. So Gene Upshaw goes back to the Oakland sideline, and he tells his teammates and Hall of Fame coach John Madden, "Buckle up your chin straps. We've just been insulted," end quote. That's what he told them. So the Raiders end up killing the Chiefs in that game 41-6. Wasn't even close. And then the Raiders later in the playoffs at the next game, they got beat by the Jets and Western Pennsylvania's own Joe Namath, who was their quarterback. They beat him at Shea Stadium in New York City. And then, of course, the Jets went on to beat the Colts in that famous I guarantee it. Super Bowl III win by Joe Namath. So another neat thing about these two 63 greats, both of them played alongside other Hall of Famers. So Gene Upshaw, of course, was playing alongside Art Shell on that great offensive line for the Raiders in the 70s for most of his career. And then Willie Lanier, who did he have? He had Bobby Bell, another Hall of Fame linebacker, right alongside him with the Chiefs. So legendary teams and playoffs and two Hall of Fame captains in Lanier and Upshaw, Hall of Fame coaches during that game with Hank Stram and John Madden, magical year in the NFL in 1968 with that epic Super Bowl. So we can have our cake and we can eat it too on the far middle with our co-dedication for episode 63 going to Willie Lanier and to Gene Upshaw. So let's take that co-dedication to those two great 63s and do what we do on the far middle. By the way, I'm Nick DeOlias. It's great to be with you. But what do? We start connecting dots, issues, themes over the half hour or so that we spend each week. And I want to start with going back to what Upshaw said when Lanier declined to take the ball when he won that coin flip. Upshaw's interpretation was, and what he said was, "We've just been insulted," right? That was his takeaway. Well, unfortunately, when I talk of we, I'm talking about Americans in general and business owners and consumers and taxpayers and workers. We've all been insulted by the current administration. And worse than being insulted, we've got a situation that is frankly disturbing to the point where it's bordering on maddening. And let me walk you through it, even though you may struggle to believe as you hear some of this, that these are things that our government is actually doing on behalf of its citizens, at least theoretically. So first, there's this U.S. law that was passed late last year, and the title of the law is the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act, which requires U.S. importers of goods from Xinjiang, China, to demonstrate that the goods were not made with slave labor. And of course, that's a huge problem with millions of imprisoned Muslims in what's Xinjiang province. And although the Chinese say it's nothing more than re-education, right, re-education camps, we know that it's a very different truth. So that law has a great intention, right? Who can be against what that law is trying to achieve? And a little supply chain transparency is not going to hurt anybody these days, especially for businesses who are trumpeting their sustainability credibility day after day. Now, the second point to consider, to put out there, what's going on with this mad dash to renewable energy in the United States, and particularly with solar, because the stuff to make solar panels does not exist at the scale needed here in the United States. We need to have that stuff mined, processed, and manufactured over there, and over there as in places like China. So China is the world's largest manufacturer of solar panels, and that's by a very wide and large margin. And the feedstock for these panels is polysilicon, of which China controls 80% of the global capacity for. So effectively, China holds a global monopoly on the crucial feedstock for solar panels. Now, the third point to consider into the analysis, guess where much of that polysilicon is found and made in China? That's right, in Xinjiang province. And do you think there might be some slave labor involved in that endeavor? Would that be a possibility? And then there is the fourth point to consider, that being the reality that China views solar panel manufacturing and all the upstream activity that goes with it, like polysilicon production, as a strategic industry or set of industries. It grows those industries, China does, it cuts prices on those products, and it swamps the supply of things like solar panels, whereby Western economies and competitors, well, they can't compete, and they can't make the solar panels themselves. So the U.S. government, right, decides to slap tariffs on Chinese solar panel imports for what we say is unfair trade practices. And the U.S. is trying to raise their costs of the Chinese solar panel imports and is trying to protect the market for the higher cost domestic solar panel producers. It's trade protectionism, essentially, which is quite ironic considering the same administration, right, won't let or allow domestic oil and natural gas to compete on their own. So maybe that's not just ironic, but also inconsistent policy bordering on the silly or insane as well. Anyway, the next point to consider, China figures a way around the U.S. tariffs on its solar panels by sending through the panels or partially making them, finishing them in close-by nations in Asia like Vietnam. So that's how they're getting around these tariffs on solar panel imports. But then the U.S. Commerce Department begins to investigate these solar imports from those nations when domestic solar panel manufacturers, they start to complain about this. Now, what gets interesting is when all of these points come together. We have all of these U.S. government intentions and desires colliding and conflicting into a massive, incoherent, and illogical mess, particularly when it meets the real world with inflation and Ukraine and energy demand and everything else. So let's play this out. On one hand, we say no slave labor built goods, and if you can't disclose that supply chain transparency, you can't import the Chinese goods under the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act. Then we say it's code red for humanity with climate Armageddon approaching, and we must plow trillions of dollars into subsidizing and paying for high cost and inefficient solar, all while ignoring its scope 3 carbon dioxide emissions, which is ironic because lowering CO2 emissions was the underlying reason we wanted to run to things like solar to begin with. But then we see China is making these solar panels cheaper than we can and is spitting out much more of them, so we slap tariffs on Chinese panels to protect domestic producers of solar panels. But then China works around that tariff by sending the solar panels first to intermediate nations in Asia so they can look on paper as if they didn't come from China, but everybody knows and sees it for what that is. But then domestic producers can't even come close to making enough solar panels to meet all these subsidized energy policy targets for solar. And the administration panics because it's starting to expose the flaw of these energy policies when inflation starts to rage across our economy. So the U.S. government waives for 2 years tariffs on solar panels coming from Asian countries close by China, the same Asian countries like Vietnam, who we all know are being used to front for the real manufacturer of those solar panels, which is China, which means we effectively waive the tariffs on the Chinese solar manufacturers that we originally slapped on them. Then all this protectionism and subsidy of solar it drives up the global prices for things like polysilicon to an 11-year high, of which China controls 80% of the supply. Our balance of trade suffers, China's balance of trade benefits. Our energy security erodes, and China and Russia's energy leverage increases. Our consumers and our business owners and our taxpayers and the climate and the middle class, they all suffer. So who wins in this mess? Well, the bureaucrat, because the system or the government grows without accountability. The subsidy-seeking, rent-seeking corporation that built a business model to feed off of all this as a beneficiary. And of course, our global adversaries. Now, when academics and books speak about the suicide of the West, you've heard that term before, the suicide of the West. This might be the exact situation that comes to epitomize the method of suicide utilized. It's self-inflicted economic death by energy policy. And all this chaos swirling around conflicting policy aims when combined with Russia and Ukraine leads to the next issue in Dot to Connect. That is how interconnected and dependent everything, and I mean everything, is to energy. Natural gas is a core feedstock for the EU. Of course, some of it is used to heat homes in winter. Some of it's used to generate electricity to power lights and EVs. Some of it's used to power transportation with compressed natural gas or CNG. And some of it's used in the chemical industries to manufacture all kinds of modern products and appliances and medicines. And some of it is used in agrochemicals to manufacture fertilizers to grow food and livestock. So it's also tied, natural gases, to our food supply. And we've talked about a lot of those issues in prior episodes of The Far Middle. But those last two uses that I just mentioned, chemicals and agrochemicals to make products and goods and fertilizer, those two industries are finding out what happens when the EU loses access to the mighty methane molecule that is natural gas. Putin is slowly turning that gas valve on pipes like Nord Stream to the closed position, and he may keep turning them all the way to closed if he does not get his way on Ukraine by the time fall and winter roll around. And this is creating a true natural gas and energy shortage when you take Russia's actions and couple them with these energy policies that created energy scarcity and inflation. So that leads to real and serious problems in the EU. Case in point, the largest integrated chemicals complex in the world, it's in the EU, it's located in Germany. That complex is run by a giant German multi-billion euro corporation. And that company said it may need to close the complex, a first in the complex's history, because of energy scarcity. Now, that would stop ammonia production from the complex, which is the key feedstock for fertilizer, which is a key ingredient, of course, to a food supply, which means traces through now. Let's see. The EU adopts energy policy that runs the domestic natural gas and oil industry to the off position, and instead has a mad dash to things like wind and solar. Wind and solar can't deliver at scale quick enough, so that means the EU has to rely on Russian natural gas to fill the void in the short and intermediate term. The prices of energy go up. Russia feels strong by all this and its energy leverage that it brings, and it invades Ukraine. It shuts down energy supply when the EU starts barking about its invasion of Ukraine. And that takes energy inflation, makes it worse, and then adds outright energy scarcity to the mix on top of the inflation. And then you see these large industrial complexes in Europe that need natural gas. They're going to have to potentially idle or reduce output. That crimps supplies of key things like fertilizer, sparking a similar crisis of inflation and scarcity when it comes to food supplies. And to top it all off, the idling or scaling back of such a massive industrial complex is going to create job losses and threaten recession at the worst possible time. So a note of sobering irony, that giant German corporation that runs the world's largest integrated chemical complex, it has a net zero carbon goal that it announced that targets the year 2050. And unfortunately, that company may get to net zero in 2022, albeit unexpectedly and not in a pleasant way for any of us. And you wonder if such a major corporation thought through all this when assessing its true risks on behalf of its stakeholders and its customers and its investors. Now, all this talk of risk amping up in the energy sector, it serves as a nice lead into our next topic to connect, which is how risk is amping up in the public pension space. And this should matter to you and concern you even if you don't receive a public pension check or if you don't work for a government entity. Because if public pensions can't meet their promises and obligations to retirees and workers in government, It's going to be the taxpayer, all of us, who are going to be on the hook in some way, shape, or form. So their problem is basically our problem. And understand risk for public pensions, it stems from two directions. One is the direction of promises made in the form of above market benefits or benefits the plan can't pay for. That's always going to be a concern, especially for public pensions where politicians and bureaucrats who get votes, budget, and campaign donations from public unions are the ones negotiating on the taxpayers' behalf. But let's put that side of the risk on the shelf for this episode of The Far Middle, and let's focus on the other side of the risk, which is the assets of the pension and how they're being invested and managed. It's scary what's going on currently across American local, state, and federal levels of government with their pensions. The first concern is how over 100 state and local municipal governments across the United States, they borrowed money and took on debt to cover their outflows. $13 billion in debt was raised last year from public pensions, and that's more than the prior 5 years combined. Pretty amazing statistic. That is not a sustainable way to run a pension plan over the long haul, and it indicates major balance sheet or cash flow problems between outlays and promises and then the inflows and funding levels. Plus, with interest rates rising rapidly, what's going to happen to the cost of that debt? It's going to rise rapidly with it. The second concern is how public pensions are plowing more assets into riskier, more volatile, and less liquid investment vehicles. So, like what type of vehicles? Well, private equity, real estate, hedge funds, and so on. And why are these public pension fund managers doing that? Because traditional equity and fixed income investment avenues, they can't offer up the returns needed to make the pension math between, again, the promises and the outlays on one side and the assets and the inflows on the other side, can't make them balance. These pensions, they need to boost returns to make up the difference. So what do? They dive into higher risk and more volatile vehicles like the ones I just mentioned. And major public pensions in the U.S. now have on average almost 25% of their assets across hedge funds, real estate, and private equity. And then the third concern, it's just the overall general market volatility and direction that we're all experiencing and going through when we look at our 401ks and our investments. Equities are in a bear market, of course. Fixed income got hit when interest rates rose, and these will hurt pension returns just like they hurt our returns, and they're going to hurt pension assets as well. That's going to make the plans more in the hole, further behind, and more likely to do desperate things and chase those returns at the cost of much higher risk. Now, I will remind the constant listeners that I dedicated a chapter of my book, Precipice, to this topic, and I encourage you to give it a read or a refresh when you've got a few minutes, because I fear my concerns are going to be realized soon in the public pension space. And by the way, of course, the net proceeds from the sale of Precipice, they go to a great cause, which is the CNX Foundation Mentorship Academy. Yes, public pensions, they are a concern, and they are political, which makes the situation doubly dangerous. And how about we spend a minute talking a little politics and political parties? Everybody, right, when you talk politics, they're talking Democrat, they're talking Republican. Are you red? Are you blue? Are you Trump? Are you Biden? But I feel like America has really fractured into more parties than just the official big two these days. I see four distinct unofficial parties when you look at the reality. So there's your classic Democrats, liberal, right, on social and individual rights, sort of tendencies toward bigger government, blue-collar labor, a key part of that constituency, sort of Bill Clinton. So when I say Clinton, I'm talking Bill Clinton here, not Hillary. Classic Republicans is the second party to think about, right? Business interests, conservative on the social front, usually tending towards smaller government, Ronald Reagan, right? Classic Republican. But now, I think there are also two new unofficial parties. You've got the hard left. These are the AOCs and the Bernies, the Antifas, creating a civil war, really, within the Democratic Party. And in this instance, with this group, laws often don't apply, especially if things don't go the way you want them to. Big business, I think, at times is afraid of them and sometimes cowers to their interests, which is often a big mistake. And then the fourth party, another unofficial one, the populist right, catalyzed by Trump. These are the sort of January 6th crew, the creating a civil war in the Republican Party, of course. And again, just like the hard left, sometimes the laws don't apply if things don't go the way you want them to. And big business by this group is viewed as a problem. So when you see that Republicans in a poll recently, which is one of the polls I saw, they place confidence in big business at a 50-year low for the party, be wary about what you're interpreting. It's people who, when pressed to pick a party affiliation, say they're Republican, but there's something different. Same for the Democrats, by the way. Now, what that means, I don't know. Maybe we need another party or two, or the civil war within both parties needs to sort itself out or themselves out so that one side is pushed out and ends up maybe ending up in the other party. Time will tell, I suppose, but I do sense thinking that our national identity when it comes to politics today is classic Republican or classic Democrat. That's a mistake. That's obsolete. It's more complicated these days. It's not unprecedented in our history, by the way. Go back and read ups on some American history. This has happened before. We've had more than two parties in the past, far from, you know, unprecedented, but different when compared to the past, say, 100 years or so, or certainly the past that we've all been used to and that we were taught and used to being surrounded by. Now, speaking of politics and parties, let's talk about the most famous of those Republican presidents, which was, of course, Abe Lincoln. He delivered that thing called the Gettysburg Address, remember? I'm not sure. Do our kids still memorize 47 years ago? The reason I'm not sure, because these days Abe Lincoln is viewed as evil by the left, and of course the left runs academia and government. Case in point, Cornell University recently removed the bust of Abe Lincoln and his Gettysburg Address from its library. Now, why did Cornell do that? Because apparently somebody complained. So now the display case in the Cornell library, at least initially after the removal, it sits there empty. What times we live in, you know, where Abe Lincoln and the Gettysburg Address can be removed by the person with the most extreme view and the thinnest skin. Let's close out episode 63, constant listeners. It is August. I believe that was the month back in 1963 when Martin Luther King delivered his I Have a Dream speech in the mall or on the mall in Washington, D.C. And if memory serves me, he did it at the top of the steps leading to the Lincoln Memorial. There's a lot of things to read and process about Martin Luther King for sure. The one thing that always stands out for me is the philosophy he applied throughout his efforts. An underpinning strategy that he employed was what he defined as spiritual aggression. So what was spiritual aggression? To him, that meant that the goal was not to vanquish or humiliate the adversary, but instead to humanize the adversary by giving them a way out of the corner that they painted themselves into, whether it be a political corner, race, or hate, whatever the case might be. And he went after evil not with a hammer and with physical force, of course, but with logic and thought that eroded the evil from within and from underneath. Pretty genius. He laid much of that approach out in a less famous speech that he gave at the same location, the Lincoln Memorial, in 1957, 6 years before that I Have a Dream speech. Now, that approach or philosophy, it took a lot of patience, right? It took a lot of courage for sure, but it worked. And it worked because it utilized the traits that the nation's ideals were based upon. Ideals that, yes, were not always followed, right? We weren't perfect, but he sort of plugged into that national character. A tricky thing to remove oppression, but to also do so in a conciliatory way. And I'm sure it's easier said than done, but no one said it or did it better than Martin Luther King. And no one was more committed to seeing it through before, during, or since. I'll see you at episode 64 in a week. And until then, stay cool.